They might as well die physically. We don't really believe that that's a natural part of growth. We take that as a birthright. We take that as something that ought to be avoided. Growth involves the same kind of loss, hopeless loss, that physical death involves. It experiences the same way. Right. Never makes sense, I suppose. It never makes sense. The loss is the aspect of growth that never makes sense. And it only can make sense as we've gone through. It is an absolutely experiential thing. So I made very, very clear in the last part of this, Yeah, I mean, absolutely clear in the last part of your scientific presentation. To say that it is to be understood in prayer, that it is a knowledge to be gained in prayer, it is one of those things which really rubs our scientific mind the wrong way. Because we want to conceptualize it, we want in intellectual terms, we want to be able to write a book that tells everybody else how to go through it, we want an equation, and we cannot do it. It is one of those things which man absolutely balks at in the 20th century because there is no way to realize that there is, in fact, a direct result from loss except as it is experienced. Now, that's really the watershed difference between psychoanalysis and many other kinds of therapy. And many kinds of therapy which can teach you how to do this and what results are. Psychoanalysis is painful and miserable, precisely because it will not teach anyone anything. It only allows them to know in experience. I know you're not satisfied. I'm not satisfied either. And I have to rely on a cliche which you don't believe many of us do. It is the nature of man. It is a part of nature which we hate in the 20th century. This one. There is a constant moving within ourselves toward growth. It's why so many of us get a bit exhausted at night because we spent the whole day resisting it. Yes, sir. Because if you don't hear it, you can't believe. Yeah. Hey, you're so perfect. Which involves a struggle. I am very, very suspicious of acceptances which say, see, that's great, I lie down and take it. That is simply not natural, and you don't get a natural result from that kind of acceptance. It is acceptance which has in it an element of resistance and despair, and it can only take place within the context of a relationship, and that's an important idea to get across. by too many people suggest it, that all you need to do is just tell people the truth, and the truth will be dismissed at a health center. And it is not the case. Too many doctors, there are too many experiences with that. You go in and you tell somebody they're going to die, and then walk out, and you come back, and you've got a patient who's so anxious, they're immediately in failure, heart failure, or something else. You don't see that. You've got to see that the truth as a process, as initiating a process within a relationship. If you don't have time to spend with a dying patient, don't tell them to die. Only as somebody who is willing to be there and stay there and work through that process, that's the only time it is safe and advantageous to tell them to die. Okay? It depends, you see, on how you live your life. That's why I pointed out my disappointment in what I hear from many, many Christian people. I hear people saying that they have used their religion to avoid loss and despair, and have thereby missed the experience of seeing that there is something qualitatively new and joyful and fulfilling when they go through that. They are content to use their religion as a kind of stabilizing factor for that person to see the truth of death and to experience would be appreciated, perhaps more than they could bear. But for a person to use his Christian faith, as I believe it was meant to be used, as a thing which constantly unfolds one, constantly faces one with loss, constantly faces one with joy and renewal, which comes not from personal effort, but from having gone through that process. I believe if the Christian faith is used that way, the final loss of death is not a fantastic evidence.
What can be the place or the role of religion in
the crucial role of providing that relationship in which it is safe to go through various stages so that stages do not become hang-ups, so that despair doesn't get to be a melancholic affair that continues endlessly. But there's a relationship where you're responsible to another person, and where they're responsible to you, then hoping, disillusionment, and despair are simply stages in a process. The relationship just cannot be overemphasized. The notion that it is just good to know the truth under all circumstances is not good, and any doctor will tell you that. But the trouble, of course, comes in that we have lost our faith in naturopathy. When we see somebody despairing, we believe we have to do something about it. I have a young friend who spent all summer in one of these outward bound programs, where they take you out in the middle of the woods and drop you off. And 6 days later, you're supposed to be 30 miles away, having subsided on drugs and meth. Now, I asked him, what in the world was so good about this? He came back ecstatic. He thought that was the most strange, the greatest experience, and it sounded miserable. Rain and cold and fear. Pain, dread, and fear of the night. And as I tried to pull him down about what he could do about it, he said, you know, the greatest thing about it is the realization that there are things in me that take over and which move me through the absolutely unbearable without my real time. Things that are really greater than my individual effort. And we've lost faith in that. We believe we've got to do something about everything. We don't believe that a person confronted with the misery and the pain of death, we don't believe that there is a natural thing in people which will take over and make of that misery something creative. We really believe that we've got to do something about it, we've got to superimpose something on it, we've got to move them along, they can't dilly dally, we have to leave them looking good and feeling good. Really, we have to leave ourselves feeling good. Now, unhappily, this is what counseling and get all too often master, as opposed to someone who can come in, be relied upon, and permit a person to go through a process in which the basic capacity of themselves to face misery are resurrected. Well, you know, a minimum time relationship, what is a minimum time relationship and the accomplishment of death as a growing, slow process? Like 10 minutes for some people, like never for some people. Right. There are some people who are primed and ready. All in the world they want is someone to talk to, who can bear to hear what they feel. And that all it takes is like yeast in a lump. It's just all you need is that there and keep moving in the same pattern. There are other people whose lives, and this is many, many people, whose lives have been spent in such a stultified, infantile way, denying their own growth, holding on to every illusion and fade of hope, that you have everything to do it, and you do them a disservice by trying to do it. Just listen. Listen to a person and see if they will give you the indications, they will tell you that they're trying to talk to you and face the truth. You have to have a little training. And this is why I like Dr. Ross. Because he doesn't tell us that it's all simple and anybody can do it. He works with physicians, he works with social workers, he works with patient placement, and he helps them understand when you can intervene, who can take it, who will really benefit now, and who is better allowed to slip off into a coma without being aware of anything. Yes. 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 Yeah, that's not totally unrealistic. But I tell you, it's reminiscent. You see, it's reminiscent of the psychoanalyst in Chicago who get wealthy patients from the North Shore of Chicago who have maintained their sanity only because there was a black cleaning lady somewhere in their house to whom the kid could turn a creation life. What I suppose you're trying to say is that if you have that intuitive ability to know who wants to talk and who will benefit from talking, then another human being, irrespective of their sophistication, can be enormously helpful. But I certainly would not suggest that just anybody knows when to intervene. I think that's simplistic. Yes.
This analogy is a beautiful one today for us, from a biologist's point of view, who know where they're here. There is a confirmation process, it appears like death, but it isn't really death, to see how time can see. And it is a part of a living system, and it is a necessary element in a continuous living system. So this is really a picture. But this is helpful to us because we know that life and the future is here. But if we are up against a precipice, and we know, as you pointed out earlier, having seen death as probably from Paul, having seen the death of our friends and loved ones, we fear a lot of ourselves for ourselves and the potential. temple of our own ourselves. And this is what a man had. And the world hasn't done a thing for the 100,000 years since men started. And the man will ask for evidence, or for evidence, and providing gifts for the dead, and so forth. And sometimes in a cultural curtain has been erected in great religion so that we can go through our past, our death, and get to some promise beyond that is realistic, that over here enough that has religion curtains or veils, that pass your eye and pass your distort the future, the beautiful picture that makes life and death and tragedy terrible. And it seems to me that you are suggesting half-putting and some promises that it's sufficient to be natural about this, and you let the feeling of natural death well up and then the future or the immediate experience will be fine, and you don't need to know the future.
Yes, I do.
You don't need explanation.
I can only tell you what I know can happen from human beings. I have my private beliefs, I have my private theology, which I hope is not too weird, but that's not why I'm here. I'm here to speak to you as a psychoanalyst who deals with human beings and human processes. Secondly, let me tell you about the patient, a young man who is painfully debilitated. He's a very, very intelligent man. Of course, this is a falsified case. I wouldn't really endorse any kind of confidence by telling you the real case, but it's falsified, like a musician can play Bach in the style of play the baseball in the style of Bach, which I'll send it to you now. A man who is terribly debilitated, terribly held up, because he, in fact, has never been able to give up a golden relationship he had with his mother for years. A really beautiful and satisfying relationship. He sees in me, as will any patient in time, the possibility of a continuing of that relationship with me. That I too will be satisfying, I too will affirm his beauty, his youth, his wonder. He finds in my silence, in the monthly bill, an occasional interpretation, that I indeed am not mother. He now begins to feel disillusioned. And he feels agony, and he feels pain. He tells me that I'm ruining his life. He tells me that the only thing worth living for is gone, is losing it. Then he goes and reads a book. And the book tells him that the psychoanalyst frustrates one's illusion in order that they may grow. And he comes back to me and says, it's okay now, I know what you're doing. And 5 years later, he's the same man. We all want to feel that there is something beyond it. We all look for those answers that you're talking about. And we never grow until we give them up. We may then find something more. But we do not grow until we have given up those answers for which we are looking. That's exactly what happened to the passage, it seems to me. But then that's another question. I understand you wish for an answer. I believe to provide it would be unrealistic for me, and I believe it is the destiny to growth. Growth is never a reasonable process. It is always involved a despair, a leap, a movement into something which seems unreasonable, and which seems like that.
I'm not the man yet. I'm only saying that the growth of the human mind over the past 100,000 years has nevertheless been a growth that has been nearly at the minute. And it is at the same time intellectual as well as emotional, and it has a future. It is a continuous process. And your suggestion that the rational elementary high ground is a member of the cross, and I'm saying that to what end?
Oh, now look, if you want to talk about the meaning of man and the meaning of growth and the purpose of man, that's your bias. That's theological. And I'm really not trying to say that. I'm only saying it happened. I said personally, for me, it is enough to know that death can be experienced as an almost joyful break into something that is impossible for me to break into even in life. I'm satisfied for me that it can be experienced that way. With pain, the fact that there may be more to it, and the fact that it may have other meaning, I'm not speaking to you. Yes. And his wife was there, and she said, yeah, but how long do you spend with him? I said, well, I think 10, 15 minutes or so. Now, I can't blame the doctor for that. He can't spend more than 10 or 15 minutes there. But the trouble is the assumption that the person doesn't want to know simply becomes, you make that assumption when in fact you haven't provided, or society does not provide, a relationship in which a person knows very well what he wants. It doesn't make much sense to me to talk about rights and that unless there is some context in which it's reasonable to talk it. In our present frame of mind, it really is not reasonable to tell too many people that they're going to die. Because they do not have anybody around who can and will stay with them, and work with them, and go through it with them. But you see, if you tell a person that they're going to die, without that sort of relationship being available, doctors have had miserable experiences. That's the truth, alone, isolated, out of time, and it usually is simply destructive. All you get from that is an anxious person who's in cardiac failure or something of the sort. It's not an assumption, it's an experience. I mean, that's not just a guess. People tell that they're going to die without a relationship available to them, do routinely suffer badly from it, and do not come out of it with a lot of good. There are rare, strong individuals like you and me who wouldn't have to have that.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And you will find a doctor who will cooperate with you in telling your patients no doubt. But the trouble is that doctors don't have that experience. They've built up something of a prejudice because they've been let down so many times. And they also know that they have with their drugs the capacity to make this passing easy, if not inconsequential. But you show a doctor a capacity and a willingness to stay with a patient. I've had that experience. People then resist. Don't want you in the room. You're going to mess things up. If you stay with it just a little while and show that position that you intend to work with the person, that you're not willing to shake them up and force them to see things, that you're going to stay with them, and the doctor will cooperate with you. Thank you very much.
It's a lot of time
the danger of all these Christians in the Bible.
I personally have long since transferred my allegiance to the central nervous system as far as human existence. But the argument of what is this body without the central nervous system, you know, is very much like arguing what are these liver cells that are still growing in culture when the individual perhaps has been dead for years. I think it's again part of the problem of trying to fit the hill. But I always thought, and I'll be glad to hear anything I was talking about, because I think it's still a highly debatable problem, but I see the individual and the humanness of man as being intimately associated with the central nervous system, and not the liver, and not the heart, and not the arms or the legs, since in a sense, these are replaceable. So I mean a law that is, these organs are viable, at least as far as the body is concerned. I don't think, well, yes and no. I think that the National Cardiac Group, I may be speaking out of turn, but I believe that they have seriously questioned, some of the societies of cardiologists have seriously questioned the justification of going on at the present time, except under the most controlled circumstances. Cardiac transplantations are still being carried out relatively infrequently at Stanford University. So that in every now and then, one will appear at one of the major medical centers in this country, that the moratorium, as I see it, has been sort of not an official policy so much, but just sort of an agreement among the medical cardiologists and the cardiac surgeons. I think they have just sort of among themselves agreed that there's been no federal regulation, nor is I know any, for instance, American Thoracic or Cardiovascular Society. I don't think it's that there will be no more cardiac transplantations done until such and such. I think it's just a sort of a gentleman's agreement among cardiac surgeons and cardiologists. Yes, sir.
You mentioned at one point, please correct me if I'm wrong, but that there is a man that about the brain and not enough of man really humanly about it, and he's really
yes, well, at least in my formal paper, and I hope in my presentation, I was speaking more of human brain death or human brain failure. There has been a considerable amount of work done in the study of brain failure under a series of controllable environmental circumstances, for instance, significant reduction in arterial oxygenation, hemorrhage, shock, this sort of thing. And not only in this country, but most appropriately in the Soviet Union, a great deal of investigation has been carried out, but in the animal. One would presume, as I am presuming, that the same sort of profiles would be, in a sense, derived if we could do the same thing in the human. My point was that we don't have this information in the human, and there may be appreciable differences. On top of that, the studies of what I quoted here of the measurement of cerebral oxygen consumption in the human. It speaks to the fact that even though these values, particularly when they get down to be a third of normal, that these people are manifesting all of the clinical findings that characterize brain death, still there is oxygen consumption. And there is still addition to the venous circulation of metabolites. So simply said, that there are portions of the human brain that are up until the point of death, which are functioning. These are subsystems. And my point is that the brain, if you demand the craftsmanship, actual cellular death, is never replaced by the now accepted 24 hour technique, or even what I'm suggesting. So if you want every single cell, that's every single neuron that the author of very respectable scientists and students who, for instance, feel that it's not only the neuron but the astrocyte which could be involved in memory. So now you've got to argue that even the glial cells as well as the man, must all be dead. Under those circumstances, even the criteria I suggest, which would necessitate invasive technique, that's what Ben Bassi. We're not answer that problem for you. Yes, it is, but what I was getting at is that really brain failure and even brain, you see, the thing is, I in some ways like the term brain failure, even though the popularization here is brain death. Because as I see it, it's a continuing process. And that we have to make a judgment
for you.
Yes, sir. Yeah, as far as the hybrid version is concerned, they're saying both. They're saying that if you follow those guidelines, you have now clinically proven irreversible coma and therefore brain death. And their judgment, which is a far more scientific diagnosis of human death, or clinical death, than any of the other possible definitions or methods. Under those circumstances, you've now defined the existence of the state of clinical death. And under those circumstances, and I don't think it's going to be very difficult in legal sense, but perhaps there'll be others who will speak of this tomorrow, then you can turn off your machine, or you can gather your organs. Now, the problem comes up is that very few people have been able to pass the bridge. Even after the transplant, of removing the heart. Because what I have said is that there is no reason why the heart, now I'm thinking, and even lungs, although they must be supported, still are in support position. The heart, when you breathe, warmer. The heart is made if you're suffering, and now you remove the heart, which is a constant, but it's still constantly tied up with our physiological thinking in terms of death. And legally it's true. There are now cases before various state courts where all the decisions, in a very frustrating application, but one of the classifications of physician, neurologist, or somebody else, adjusts the man by turning the hand. Which means you have more than 24 hours. And that doesn't happen that way. It's a matter of 2 hours. Even without a factor or infection. So, under those circumstances, they have removed the heart for transplantation. Now, this man was shot by another man. The question comes up, they can't kill the patient. There's a man who found in the head of a neurologist pronounced him as brain dead and therefore clinically dead for the patient, which is the utilizing of the patient. So you see, even now the highest group is very happy with your separation. The legal situation has not been worked out in every state. Now the United clinicians feel comfortable yet about making a definition of that. They don't feel so bad about food and things like this, but they're very concerned really about removing that heart to good food. But what's the big difference? So you see, you've got this building in our mind. But you know, let me give you an example. 10 years ago, I lectured on the morality of modern medicine in a number of Eastern universities under somewhat different religious circumstances. And I found a tremendous difficulty in answering questions that many of the young women brought. Now, the example I was using then was this. And I'd like to see how it fits with your decision. Because the goal of something that you admit is not true yet, but if you're in the realm of possibility, and I don't think that's really the goal. The first thing that is supposed to be done is that if you were the mother of a child, which was just to be physically ordered, from the standpoint of brain and other body organs, except the heart. So this child is born with a general heart condition, which is known by all medical criteria to be a such a serious condition in a matter of, let's say, several years. So you think about it, this child will die out of the children's heart. Now, we know that there are many hospitals. And there are many, in a sense, homes for children whose water system, in a sense, never developed. And these studies, unfortunately, are for 400 years,
from our child income. And if people find it in the post, days later, it gets them out of order. They learn then, they find out. And this comes from the living out in the world. And so, really, the most important thing that you need to run your heart and your mind very well is when you start. This is one of the reasons why, if you take electrolytes, if you can't use them, and demonstrate the complete absence of electroactivity at the most primitive level, the lowest status of life, then the theory of disability that would be treated with the consequences. But until we have enough faces in abundance, we can only surmise from the animals that the different places in the situation. But I remember a very distinguished theologian in Mexico talking me on his problem. Is that where is the brain dead? I mean, are you talking about cortical death? Are you talking about thalamus, the basal ganglion death? Are you talking about diencephalic hypothalamic death? Are you talking about brain dead death? I told him we were just talking about the general observation of things. Because I guess basically is what we think of for the reconstitution of an individual. But there are many, many untried problems. You need to try the same. The whole problem of brain failure, even in the animal, but most certainly in man, has not been examined. Yes, sir. Well, I'm getting hung up in this one. After all, he was composing my death. But, well, I'm thinking that people in the world are utilizing all of the extraordinary means that were possible at a university that was known for these capability, the University of Minnesota. And he kept his patient and quoted for that. I mean, they had others as Alfred and Dr. Hester Thompson, and they enabled the whole ECG and spinal reflex. So you see, they didn't fit into the having criteria. And then he operated that to the gravity of his patient for me. But their brains had been destroyed, but he still basically imposed these extraordinary means until they simply ran out of steam. They got pneumonia or some other basic condition that even presently protective medicine couldn't treat. And then they did, in fact, totally die to life. And when they autopsy these patients, they've been kept this way. In badly, the brain stem had almost become or converted to liquefaction. Either were tremendous impulse infections in this small segment of the brain. I could just use the term as sustained. But it's hard for us to get away from this terminology. The gentleman asked back there that we keep using this term alive and living and so forth, but it's hard to redefine the term. Yes, sir.
They do the game that the Italians have already played, they say that what the human being has become irreversibly unconscious. They talk to them, they say, boom. And they say, the human being is dead.
Well, I really believe that most of us, I think most of us, who are interested in this field, either as neurologists or neurosurgeons, would accept the last thing you said. In other words, this thing can really be at the bottom. The first thing is, the point, the unconscious, the last thing. Then, of course, we could make the argument that the person never will have the capacity to express himself in any way. So what we're saying here is that there's not part of the problem that we have not had to do. We have all of us, we have this nation, who in a sense are an irreversible planet, but they have a very excellent human being. They know it's fine. But at this point, will they ever express themselves or get any indication other than, say, the shell of a limb, say, if it's painfully feeling, of receiving any vocal or vocal commands or, in a sense, ever express themselves in a communicative way?
And in some instances, we cannot use the term, even though they put you in any irreversible time. We don't know anything. We can tell you our definition where the easy to be found. That's how it's life. And then we see the examination, so the person has no reflexes, and so on and so on and so forth. Now, if they are a person in the patient, they can take the soul, point.
I understand that. But we don't make the definition of irreversibility unless the coma remains for 24 hours and the EEG remains stopped and all of these neurological exam features also demonstrate unresponsiveness on the part of the nervous system. So all of these have to be added to the coma function. There's one other major feature here, and I'd like to mention, because the programs that have been set up at many universities and many medical centers for making this definition need our one important thing. It's mentioned, and that is, what is wrong with this? And this is why I stress the patient who has had a bad hemorrhage was operated on by the surgeon. He knows, he has seen the drug, he knows that it was so severely damaged, it gave it a chance that this person was incapable of recovery. You had a patient that operated on, say, 6 or 8 months ago. Now we're saying the coma, the phone, you can say, you know, this person had a tumor that's presented to remove. It's highly malignant. It's not the individual that comes to your clinic, brought in by the family and said, well, this young man has a lot of coma this afternoon, I want to think of it. But frankly, what was wrong with the patient? What is his actual condition? Knowing he's had an overwhelming stroke, and his blood into his brain. They had a serious car, and now we told them what you're doing. Then they think, where is all these purpose for your headache? This is not sick. And I think that's so important. So you know that you have a patient with an overwhelming brain disease, which now has all these other issues. The possibility is that if anything happens to him, that is the problem. And probably far less. And as I mentioned, as I said, the patient in drug intoxication, and or his body temperature has been significantly lower
or you can have any life around to it. So that is evident. All of these are things, or lack of things, you want to say that. And yet, you can't apply them, because this brain still has the capacity of recovery.
And this is not the case from somebody who is not overwhelming one hand, or two men, or injured.
So I would say, in answer to the question, is that the harder people need to find really go to the point, just how they start out. And they investigated this pathway, they set out questions with the person. But they don't know, they don't accept this definition at all. I mean, if they go on to a patient and say, well, this patient's in pain. They don't accept the term
or the word really there today.
Unless these other factors, 1, 2, 3, 4, are looked for and are asked, and there is a certain part of one's own. Then we go into the place to turn very little body in one point.
But not before.
Now, my argument is that in this particular case, as you say, it's going to be a change. The people bring that. And that, and that before the clinic. And here's the truth, things like that. And I'm not sure, I don't know if you would have been answered, but this is far, this is a crazy. It's much more accepted in your country than it is for an English.
There's tremendous resistance among some of these outstanding members of the medical profession in England.
And this is far. There's a very heavily at the international sanitation meeting, the whole of this. It was found to be totally unacceptable to the British members. They said they would not buy the concept that brain death equals clinical death. Now, they were transplant surgeons, they were working around this very business. But even though they were in the group that were looking for organs, and one of the hardest organs for transplantation, they found it frankly unacceptable. And they are ready. Those interventions in this country are made for this to understand the notice that we are not quite satisfied with this equation, even after 24 hours. Listen,
you have to originally type the criteria and you could say you could isolate and modify the specified. You also need to be obligated in some areas. You're only curious about the operator, but this area of time, it suggests that the issue is changing. Now, I believe if you have any restrictions, or if you're going to be able to get any kind of problem, now, exactly what is the intended effect of any cure, but it's depending on the history of life and the business, that all the criteria that we can use. You have to continue to study. And when you start to find out how the relationship to food, that's how you get to the position where the position is at. And the summarizing of that is every day, simplified to
the human being. Well, I think that's in some ways the crux of the matter. And it's probably the problem in many hospitals today.
First of all,
we're about to announce the death of this particular session. One can only fire always. I think you and I should talk about this privately, but I would like to say, as I said very briefly, that the danger to a degree is secondhand. First of all, these patients are seen by individuals who are highly trained and who make a specialty of examining and treating the nervous system. And further, Caroline, is that this patient is known to have a disease of the nervous system. And above all, if it's been verified by neuroradiological studies, are even more appropriately treated. Under these circumstances, I think the physician's opinion carries tremendously. The danger is where you don't have this information,
and you're looking at somebody who is often lost, who's been brought in the car. And under these circumstances, we must, in a sense, keep away this vulture-like concept that the public often brings. But I can only say that the responsibility for making these judgments, for or against the person being dead or not dead, is solely rests with his own position, and he must never be influenced by the transplant surgeon or the patient down the hall is so desperately in need of a kidney. I think this is totally wrong. It's the responsibility of the people who are going to make this definition as to the patient himself. So thank you for your attention.